AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am here with David Canfield, the lone representative of our usual crew. Hello, David.
Hello. I'm feeling lonely today.
Well, we're here together. And also with Richard and Rebecca, often can. You'll hear from them a bit later. We've brought in a very special guest, our friend, our VF Weekends colleague. Hello, Jordan Hoffman.
Bonjour. I am here from France. My name is Jordan, and I have flown in from the Côte d'Azur.
There we go.
Did I just offend all the French listeners with my accent?
I wonder how many French listeners we have.
We'll I think they're all in Cannes. They're all taking the week
That's
off.
That's true. So we're good. They're too busy. Jordan, we brought you here to talk about Star Trek, and then also you got to bust out your French accent. So I feel like we're hitting the highlights real fast here. So we'll hear from Richard and Rebecca later with the Dispatch looking ahead toward Cannes. As we record this, the festival is basically just kicking off. So they kind of looked ahead to the big titles to look out for. And we'll talk about Star Trek and friendship because Jordan Hoffman has a new book called The Star Trek Book of Friendship. We'll give you lots of opportunities to plug it later on. But first, there's Oscar news, which is I described as not news on any podcast except this one. But there's a date for next year's Oscars. It's on March 12th, which is a little bit earlier than last year, not nearly as late as the year before that. David, is there any meaning to be drawn out of any of this? It seems like a pretty standard schedule after 2 years of semi-chaos.
Yeah, it seems like they continue to slightly wind back the clock, so we aren't stuck in that late April Oscars afterglow, which was delayed due to the pandemic, of course. Last year, we were March 27th, or this year, I should say, which was pretty late. I think it's the Academy doing what it should do. I think it's in the right space this year, more of a mid-March date. And they have no control over the fact that Oscar season is endless, and we start way too early regardless, and they are not to be blamed for that, I suppose. We should turn our attention to the studios launching campaigns in the summer.
And those year-round awards podcasts that just talk about it forever. Like they got,
what is with those?
How dare they? one significant change, I think the Governor's Awards had been slated to be in January all along last year, and then they got delayed by the Omicron surge, and it kind of petered out. But this year, they'll be back in November, the weekend before Thanksgiving, which I think is traditionally like a convenient time for a lot of people to get their campaigns in gear. That seems like a good move to me. How about you, David?
Very good move. I'm sure everyone who likes to campaign and go to the Governor's Awards is very happy because it there's a reason to go. The voting is not closed as it was this past year. It's a great event, though. You hope that, there are rising COVID cases right now, as there are every 3 or 4 months.
Sure.
So it's perhaps a weird time to say that you hope for even more of a return to normalcy next season, not just in like famous people going to big fancy parties, but in terms of movies getting the rollout they deserve, getting seen as they deserve, and as the marketing is hoping they get seen, which didn't happen for a couple of movies this past cycle. And this is all a part of that. This is all, I think, the Academy saying we are in a moment of relative stability right now. Let's try to get back on track after the chaos, as you say, of this past year.
Yeah.
So the Governor's Award, normally the party is after the voting has completed. But this
normally it's like well before.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, so the nominees can feign an appreciation for
Danny Glover.
Right, exactly. I've always loved his work. I'm here really to shake hands. Yeah.
I remember a couple years ago, the year Renee Zellweger won, and just watching her go to every seat at the Governor's Awards. It was impressive, and she seemed genuinely thrilled to do it.
Well, and you think about the timing in November, like even the Critics Awards haven't started coming out yet. Everyone's got a chance. So every studio can buy a table. There's certainly a good reason to have it that early in the cycle.
That year, that Zellweger year was like a dream campaigning year because you had her, Brad Pitt, and Laura Dern, who were just legends having the time of their lives, glad handing for 6 months. And then I guess you had Joaquin Phoenix doing whatever he was doing.
Miserably shuffling from room to room.
Yeah. It was the ideal vibe, though, of people who where it's not too much work for them to spend a few hours in a ballroom at the Beverly Hilton.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask about that early January window now, because we had the news from last week that the SAG Awards won't be on TNT or TBS. It's definitely the potential for them to move. The Critics' Choice Awards are still kind of hovering over the Golden Globes' former spot. But, you know, there's one award show in early January that's not going anywhere, and that's the New York Film Critics Circle Awards, chaired by one Jordan Hoffman.
Yeah, this year's going to be nuts because they're going to let me talk. Well, you know, we don't televise our awards. We do record the audio, and maybe I'm going to make a scoop here on Little Gold Men. You ready for the little scoop? Who wants a scoop?
I want
the New York Film Critics Circle, the most august critics group in America, certainly the second oldest on the planet. There is one in Britain that's a little bit older, but we go back to 1935, and we do have audio going back, so I'm told, about 20 years. And there is going to be an effort made, I can't say exactly when, but soon we will begin to release some of these audio clips of people accepting their awards. And that's fun because, Katie, you've been to the NYFCC gala number of times. Some of those awards speeches and also the presentations from big A-listers are oftentimes hilarious, partially because they're not on TV, so people can cut loose a little bit
and talk forever.
Sometimes go on, but always nice. Lady Gaga last year, or this year I should say, you know, she let loose, but it was great because everybody loves her and she deserved that win. And but you know, a couple of years ago, Adam Sandler, who did not win, but he introduced the Safdie brothers because they won, I believe, the Best Director Award.
That was that same Renee Zellweger, Brad Pitt campaign year, the pre-COVID campaign year. We all remember it so fondly.
You know, Adam Sandler did a show. It was like he was at the Improv or Caroline's. He just did a bit and it was amazing. And yes, the New York Film Critics Circle in January, we'll be back. We're usually the first one out of the gate in early January, and we'll be back again next year, assuming, of course, there's no, we did Omicron. I don't know which Greek letter is next. Maybe it's a rho or, you know, Omega sounds particularly threatening. I hope it's not the Omega variant.
I don't know. Maybe that can be the end. Omega can be done with this. Well, I wanted to ask you about that, too, because we have news about your early January rival, the Golden Globes, which I can barely make heads or tails of. There was a press release last week about them. It sounds like they're considering being bought. And David, you seem like you understand this a smidge better than I am. What can we tell that this means, if anything?
As far as I can tell, this is me maybe taking a bit of a leap here, but the Golden Globes are in a lot and very much in limbo this year because, unlike this past year where NBC was just basically like, we are not airing the show, we are taking a year off to reassess, this year I don't believe that we know whether or not they're going to be on NBC. And meanwhile, there's this whole thing, as you mentioned earlier, with the SAG Awards and whether they can take a larger network chunk of that precursor audience. To me, this reads like the HFPA has not gotten to where they need to become, again, the big splashy, boozy pre-Oscars party that they were in 2020. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because essentially they had brought in Todd Boehly, who has been the HFPA interim CEO for a few months now. And from what I can understand, he had put forth a proposal. Yeah, so essentially they've opened the door to selling, for lack of a better way of putting it. The statement is incredibly wordy and confusing, and I think intentionally so. I don't believe that we have... I think we've learned to not expect transparency from this organization, and they've certainly struggled mightily over the past year to regain the cachet that they very swiftly lost. It's also worth noting that they had lost their PR firm, Sunshine Saks, mm-hmm. which had been with them through probably the darkest period when, you know, a lot of A-listers were calling them out and NBC was, you know, abandoning ship, at least temporarily. And so now they do a lot of their PR in-house. This is probably the first big press release we'd gotten from them. And judging by it, it's, I'm wondering if they should start soliciting an agency for their communications, because it's very confusing and it's likely just masking an attempt to find someone who can salvage whatever's going on over there.
Well, they're probably going broke. I mean, if they didn't have a TV deal last year, they probably don't have that much. But the good news is for them, I guess, is they can only go up. They're absolutely in the toilet now. They have no cachet. They weren't on TV. You had actors sending the trophies back, right?
Did anyone actually do that? Or did Tom Cruise just say he would?
People said they did, and I would not.
I think Tom Cruise did it.
He's a man.
I would be interested for like someone to like go find that, go see where the trophy landed.
You got to get on the helicopter.
I was going to say, not only did he send it back, he flew it back himself.
Yeah, what if he drops it out of his helicopter over Cannes as a symbolic you know, the
what, by the way, guys, what's going on with our friend Sean Penn? He was supposed to smelt his Oscars when Zelensky didn't show up.
Right.
And everybody forgot because of this fakakta, Chris Rock, what's his name, smacking him across the face.
I can't believe you just forgot Will Smith's name.
Yeah, Will Smith, that guy. But no more. 12 hours earlier, the story of the day was Sean Penn vowing on CNN that he was going to smelt his Oscars. I went and looked up. Oscars are made primarily out of bronze. We're talking 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. He did, you know, that's a tall order. So I figured I'd give him at least a week to find a good smelting operation out there in Eastern Europe.
He's just promoting Gaslit like nothing happened.
Yeah, he's in his fat suit now. He's unrecognizable.
What a skunk. What a skunk. About the Golden Globes, here's the thing. I think that they're never going to go away because that phrase, the Golden Globes, is very, very famous. People who would never in a million years listen to this podcast, who don't go to the movies, who don't care about any of this stuff, they've heard of the Oscars and they've heard of the Golden Globes. It's really well known. So somebody will buy it and then they can possibly rebuild. They need a tremendous amount of reform. They need to get rid of a lot of their membership. They need to find new membership. But I do think they can rebuild. And I think that somebody will invest in buying the brand because it's a real brand. Whether it deserves to be, it deserves that or not is open to debate, but I do think that there is a future for the Golden Globes. So, and they can only go up. I mean, it can only get better for them.
Yeah. In a time when award shows are like declining in relevance, the fact that the Golden Globes is something that people know about, that you're right, that means something.
Yeah, SAG awards don't mean much to commoners, you know, even though we recognize them for what they are, but the Golden Globes are, you know, they're a thing.
So if we were to place our bets now, do we think that the Golden Globes will air on television in some capacity in January?
I think it will be streamable. Maybe not on network television. But I think maybe Tubi TV or Pluto, or one of those weird ones. No, maybe like a Peacock or something will have it available. I don't think you're going to tune in to NBC or ABC or one of the big boys at night on a Sunday night and have it. But maybe in the future, you know?
Well, then the second question is if it's not happening that way, then will anyone be there?
Or even conversely, how does that impact the airing possibilities, because the broadcast possibilities? Because the big concern for them is how much of Hollywood has indefinitely abandoned them and does not want to deal with them and now doesn't have to deal with them, which has to do with how the HFPA in various ways has conducted itself for a number of years. So that's the other really big question is Hollywood willing to welcome them back and in what capacity? Because I totally agree with you, Jordan, that they do have an ability to come back just based on the power of their brand. But they tried to get some people involved in last year's show and they couldn't even do that. And,
No, it's a good point. They would need to do a real overhaul, to hire a new public face and people who have some, you know, some clout and some respectability.
Yeah. Do any of us have international citizenship that would qualify? I don't.
I have international residency.
Oh yeah, you have enough New Zealand background, David. I feel like you could really sneak in there somehow and revamp it from the inside.
I'll get Jane Campion and Melody Linsky all the line, and we're gonna figure this out.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So now we're going to hear from Richard and Rebecca, who recorded a segment before they headed off to France to talk about Cannes. But before we throw to them, Jordan, you are a Cannes veteran here who we have brought in, and you have seen probably the biggest movie premiering there, Top Gun Maverick. What do you want to preview more? Do you want to talk about Top Gun, or do you want to talk about what you are expecting from this year's Cannes?
Oh, well, I'm not at Cannes this year, and I have gone many times in the past, so I am suffering greatly from a debilitating case of Cannes FOMO. Mm-hmm. And there is no emergency Paxlovid from the government that's a COVID deep cut. There is no emergency Paxlovid from the government that can cure me of my Cannes FOMO. So I've been trying not to pay attention to what's going to be happening out there too much, so I don't have too many picks on what's going to pop. I mean, I've heard some things, and I've seen one or two things. I am excited for Elvis. I mean, I'm excited for Elvis. Maybe that makes me,
me too.
A mark.
Oh, I'm excited for Elvis.
Yeah.
And continuing in our tradition of people who are not going to be nominated, making grand dramatic pronouncements about what they'll do if things don't happen the way they want to at the Oscars, Lisa Marie Presley is going to eat her own foot.
She's going to eat her own foot.
If Austin Butler does not win Best Actor.
Good for her. Good for her. And Priscilla.
She and Sean Penn.
Yeah, Priscilla. Yeah. Eat your first, smelt the foot, then eat it. And Priscilla said she loved it, too. And, you know, I mean, I guess it's in their interest to say they like it, but they don't have to. They can keep quiet.
The long history of people whose families are in biopics, like how they weigh in and what they say. I mean, we just went through it with the Williams family. It never stops being fascinating.
Arnaz biopic.
Oh, yeah.
What's interesting is if you go deep on Priscilla's comments and Lisa Marie's comments, which for some weird reason I did, neither of them say much of anything about Tom Hanks. Lisa Marie said nothing, didn't even mention him. And Priscilla said, blah, 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 the Colonel, what a character. I got to see all sides of him, and he has an interesting story. So she was like political about the Colonel, because obviously he made Elvis, but he also broke Elvis's heart and blah, blah, blah. And the thing is, if you watch the trailer to Elvis, Tom Hanks is really going for it with that accent.
Oh, yeah.
And if you watch video of Colonel Tom Parker, whose real name was, you know, something very Dutch, he has a mild Dutch accent. He doesn't sound like Dracula or whatever. Like, you know, if you were to meet Colonel Tom Parker, you'd be like, where's this guy from? He's got a tinge of an accent somewhere, but I don't know where he's from. And Tom Hanks is really going for it. But it's not like Baz Luhrmann is known for reeling it in. So, but yeah, the other big movie, a big Hollywood movie you mentioned is Top Gun. And I have seen it, and it's quite a motion picture.
Do you feel like it lives up to the big Cannes hype history of Mad Max Fury Road or Shrek? What a legacy.
Yeah, no. The truth of the matter is I really like Joe Kaczynski, the action director. This is his fourth film. None of his movies have been major hits. And Tron Legacy was a bit of a flop. I mean, Tron Legacy was whatever what it was. Then he made Oblivion, which did well, but it was not a monster hit. And then he did the Fireman movie with Miles Teller. I think it's called Only the Brave or something like this.
Oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
Forgot that.
It's really good. It's really, really good. He is a really good stylist. And then he's got Spider Baby coming out later this summer. Spider-Land. He's got a Netflix
movie. Spider-Head.
Spider-Head, yeah.
Yeah, with Hemsworth.
Honestly,
right?
Hemsworth. And also Miles Teller.
And Miles Teller, yeah.
Yeah. Kaczynski's got a look. And, a movie like Top Gun, how much of that does the auteur theory come into play? God only knows, but there are sequences in Top Gun 2 written. The script is like a G.I. Joe episode from the 80s. It's a cartoon. But the way it's cut together, the slickness, the thrust, the propulsive energy, not to use jet fighter terms, but it really does work in this case. It's exciting stuff. It's really, really, really good action filmmaking. I mean, you come out of this the way you come out of Cameron's Terminator 2. Like,
whoa.
Holy smokes. It's like, it's nonstop. And the plot is just idiotic. It's basically Star Wars. They got to go destroy the Death Star and they got to zoom in and whatever. It's
and
like
not the name the enemy, right? Isn't that
no,
the whole
they're
thing?
they're just vague villains. It's preposterous. Jennifer Connelly is just, it's so embarrassing what they'd make her do in this movie. I mean, she's just a non-entity. She just shows up periodically as a walking studio note of like, oh, you got to have a woman in this movie somewhere. And one of the flyers is a woman in this. I forget her call sign. It's like they all have, like Maverick and Goose. The new ones are like Payday and whatever they're called. One of them is called Fanboy. The font on his helmet is the Star Trek font, which I thought was nice because they're both
Ooh.
Paramount properties.
A nice tie-in to our next conversation, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought that was nice synergy on behalf of the studio. Anyway, Top Gun 2 is really good. I mean, it's idiotic, but it's good. I really enjoyed it. And it's better than the first movie. I mean, I rewatched the first movie, the day before I saw the new one. And it's just simply like, this has more energy, more action, more Tom Cruise being Tom Cruise. And the first one had beach volleyball. This has beach touch football.
Great.
So I don't know if that's
more American sport.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, I think Richard and Rebecca will have the more auteur-focused part of Cannes ahead for us. And we did talk about Top Gun last week, though, and I think, Jordan, you're far from the only one who's really into this new one. So
yeah,
with
a lot of asterisks of like one of Maverick's phrases is "Don't think, do." And that's it. If you, God forbid, you think during this movie, you're going to say, like, what am I doing with my life? I got to get out of here. It's really, really dumb. But it's really energetic and entertaining.
All right. Well, let's hear about the rest of Cannes and throw to Richard and Rebecca.
So, Rebecca, we're going to France.
We are.
How about that? This is your first time at Cannes since what, 2019?
2019. I've really missed it. I'm excited, but I do feel like it'll probably feel a little different this time. You went last year, right? So what was that like?
I did. That was weird because it was in July instead of May, and it was very hot, and there were soccer hooligans everywhere because the Euro Cup was happening, and Delta variant was stalking the streets, and there was a new ticketing system introduced that will be there this year, too. So I'm happy to be going back to the regular climes of May when the festival can take over the town and not contend with, summer tourists and soccer fans and all that. Sorry, football fans. So part of the excitement, or most of the excitement, I would assume, is related to the lineup of Cannes this year. So I'm curious, Rebecca, what is the title that glares most brightly from that lineup announcement?
I do feel like the film that people are talking about the most to me is the Cronenberg, Crimes of the Future. I don't know if it's just the mix of the cast or the fact that he hasn't had a film since 2014 or what, but I feel like that's the one I'm hearing a lot about. I don't do great with body horror, so on my personal list, it's probably not at the top, but it does feel like it has a lot of buzz going into this.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Cronenberg's last film, Maps of the Stars, won Best Actress for Julianne Moore at Cannes, it's many years later, but he's coming off of a successful debut at Cannes. So that's that adds to the excitement. But yeah, that cast, Viggo Mortensen, Lea Seydoux, who I think has like 20 movies at the festival this year, Kristen Stewart, obviously, Scott Speedman, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Canadian director working with Canadian actor. I'm similar with you on the body horror thing. My hope is that there is, I don't know. I mean, it's deliberately called a body horror film on Wikipedia. I was going to say my hope is that it's like a little bit more than that. It's elevated body horror, but
there's definitely like an ear on a forehead or something in the trailer that I was like, oh no. Like just...
right. But it's exciting. I feel like, you know, Cronenberg is somebody who gets spoken about a lot with David Lynch. They kind of came up around the same time. They both had their have their sort of idiosyncratic fixations. And there was a rumor that there would be a David Lynch film premiering at Cannes this year, which is does not appear to be happening unless they have really pulled a fast one on us. But it's great that we at least get a Cronenberg big thing in main competition.
Yeah. What are you hearing that or what is most exciting to you, Richard?
Well, I think for our podcast purposes and maybe VF's broader purposes, like Elvis, obviously the Baz Luhrmann film with Tom Hanks and Austin Butler, who people might know from the Carrie Diaries. He was briefly in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's playing Elvis. I'm very curious, as I'm sure you are, Rebecca. Is that like a big Oscar performance? It seems like it is from the trailer.
Yeah.
I'm curious if Luhrmann, who always gets some Oscar nominations, some, you know, usually for like craft categories, you know, he's gotten other, you know, Moulin Rouge obviously did very well at the Oscars. I'll be curious to see how far he can take that because his last debut at Cannes, which was Great Gatsby, did well commercially, but didn't really connect on a sort of awards narrative basis. Unless, am I remembering wrong? But that didn't get like acting nominations
right,
or anything.
Right. I think that's right. Yeah. I
so
mean,
I'm curious about that.
He's had a lot of success at Cannes, obviously, with Moulin Rouge was also there and Strictly Ballroom. I can't help but compare it to sort of the Rocket Man trajectory since that was also a Cannes debut, but maybe it'll be very different. I don't know. But that one had a huge party at Cannes, I do remember. So maybe this will at least have that.
Were you and I at the same party, but we didn't know it because we didn't know each other?
Where Elton John performed on the stage at the beach? Yes, we were at the same
party. I was there.
One of the best.
Texting my mom, saying, oh, I'm seeing, oh, she's like, what's going on? Oh, Elton John's performing. And she was like, what? I was treating it perhaps too casually. I think Rocket Man, you know, superior film to Bohemian Rhapsody, but Bo Rap was the one that went on to awards glory, which I thought was kind of a shame. But I guess Elvis could go one of either of those ways or a different way, you know, maybe it's a complete disaster, but I don't know. The trailer is intriguing enough. And don't we all want to see the movie that gave Tom Hanks COVID?
Oh yeah. There you go. That's the reason to tune in if nothing else.
the story that started it all. Is there anything on the kind of smaller scale that we don't know much about, but the director intrigues you or the title does or an actor in it?
Personally, Ruben Östlund is like my favorite filmmaker. I thought Force Majeure was my favorite film of that year. I think The Square was so wonderful. I guess his films are considered smaller, right? And he has Triangle of Sadness this year, which, you know, he's taking another sort of shot at the wealthy elite. This time it's on a cruise ship, I think. And it has Woody Harrelson. So I'm curious if this is going to be sort of a really great Woody Harrelson performance. But like on my personal, what I really want to see, I feel like that's definitely my number one. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of Harris Dickinson playing a model, I mean, that's just outrageous. I mean, that's just such strange casting. I don't understand. Yeah, that's definitely high on my list. You know, he's coming off a Palme d'Or win. Force Majeure was on my best of the decade list. I think that movie is excellent. The American remake is okay, but people should seek out the original because it's really special. Mia Hansen-Love has a film called One Fine Morning that is in the Uncertain Regard, or no, excuse me, Director's Fortnight category, which is one of the sidebar things that's not officially part of Cannes, but is very much treated like it is. Another Lea Seydoux movie. Hansen-Love had Bergman Island at Cannes last year, and I saw it having waited in line or walked from my apartment in like 100% humidity and was kind of miserable. And I don't think I absorbed that film as well as I should have. And I really loved it only on second viewing back in New York. So I'm hoping that this one does not fall victim to other circumstances it can't control, because I think she's one of the most reliably interesting filmmakers going. One of these Lea Seydoux movies has to pop. And so
it
maybe
to.
It's this
it's
one.
The rule.
She won't be in the running for like the big prizes, but maybe it could help her momentum for another film.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of interesting filmmakers in the lineup. I think that's what makes it so exciting this year. I'm curious to see George Miller's film. It's a fantasy romance, I think is how it's been described. And Idris Elba plays some sort of genie giving Tilda Swinton three wishes. And it's called 3,000 Years of Longing. So I'm definitely curious to see that. Obviously, it's not the Mad Max style of his last Cannes film, but could be something different and interesting.
Yeah, it's out of competition, which mm-hmm. I think does not say anything about its quality necessarily. It's just sometimes bigger, more quote unquote commercial movies just like to do that and not have this sort of be vying for awards, and thus they look bad if they haven't won anything. And so, I think that's definitely going to be one of the big buzzed about titles, especially because Mad Max Fury Road premiered at Cannes as well, and obviously propelled that movie toward a lot of glory down the road. There are so many returning directors this year. Koreeda, the Japanese mm-hmm. filmmaker, has a movie called Broker. He won the Palme d'Or for Shoplifters. And then he did an English language movie with Ethan Hawke and Catherine Deneuve and I think Juliette Binoche, right? And mm-hmm. that was at Venice. So now he's back at Cannes with something set in Japan that I believe is about child adoption, I think.
Yeah, I just watched the trailer and it looks really good. I mean, you know, sticks with his themes that he's known for, but it's Song Kang-ho, who was, you know, is a very well-known Korean actor, but was the lead in Parasite. And it looks like they're sort of like trying to sell a baby, but which I think is probably why it's called Broker. But they're kind of this like group of ethically questionable people who form a family, that sort of thing. So I'm definitely pumped to see that one after seeing the trailer, too.
Yeah, and then we have Park Chan-wook coming back, mm-hmm. the Korean director, with a film called Decision to Leave. You know, he had The Handmaiden at Cannes a few years ago that was kind of tipped to win the Palme d'Or, but then didn't, strangely. I believe that was the year that the Ken Loach film won. Mm-hmm. I remember that because Donald Sutherland was on the jury, and he fell asleep right next to me during a screening of The Handmaiden.
And you're like, this isn't going to end well.
I was like, oh, that doesn't bode well.
You didn't try to like gently elbow him awake?
I probably should have, but I think he had like an assistant with him who should have been doing that. Obviously, all eyes are on the Korean entertainment industry at the moment because of Squid Game, because mm-hmm. of Parasite. And I think that Park Chan-wook is one of the filmmakers, I think, credited with the start of this Korean film boom 20 something years ago. So it'll be exciting to see his latest, given the big competition slot. And then, you know, we have some first time competition people. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Rebecca, but Kelly Reichardt has not been in competition at Cannes before, right?
That's right. Yeah. Which is surprising. It's insane, but true.
What is her movie again?
Showing Up, which stars Michelle Williams. Obviously, they work together a lot, and I'm excited to see another performance, another collaboration between the two of them. But yeah, she was Kelly had a film in Uncertain Regard before, but not in the main competition.
And it's described as kind of a comedy, like a workplace art world comedy, I think, which is a different vibe for Kelly Reichardt has done things that are like amusing in her films before, but mm-hmm. I don't really think of them ever being like haha funny. So I'm curious how that's going to take shape, because she's such a deliberate filmmaker and keyed into her specific style that it'll be interesting to see her working in maybe a slightly new genre.
Yeah.
And then let's see what else. I'm looking at the main competition lineup. Lucas Don't. That's an interesting story. He has a movie called Close. He's a Belgian filmmaker who a few years ago won several awards for a film called Girl that was in Uncertain Regard. And not to give myself too much credit, but that movie, which is about a trans teenage girl ballerina who really wants to get gender confirmation surgery and is being denied that by her family. And it takes a really unsettling turn. Anyway, I saw it and it was very well received at Cannes. And I said to an American colleague, I was like, that is not going to go well in the States. And I was right. It was received a very different reception. So obviously he was successful at Cannes. Lucas Don't was. So I'm curious to see how he fares with his second outing and if he is going to be courting controversy in the same way.
That's interesting. Oh, and then we haven't talked about James Gray is going to be in competition with his Roma, as we've been calling these. It's sort of a more personal coming-of-age story. It's called Armageddon Time, and it stars Anne Hathaway and Anthony Hopkins and method actor Jeremy Strong. I feel like there's definitely some promise there with that one as well, with that cast.
Now, do we know if it's black and white?
Oh, gosh.
How much of a Roma is it, you know?
I feel like, yeah, there's been no images yet, right? So we don't actually know.
It's fun to think if you want to group Armageddon Time with another film that, like, so Gray is getting his stamp on the genre this year ahead of Spielberg, who also has his Roma coming out later this year, The Fablemans. You know, they are not similar filmmakers in most ways, and certainly Spielberg has a much higher profile. But James Gray, I think, is a filmmaker who has been simmering for a while and has just narrowly missed major, like, awards attention year after year, you know, film after film. I think The Lost City of Z from, what is that, 2017, is, I think, a brilliant, brilliant movie. And I was sad that that didn't get the attention I think it deserved. You know, I think Marianne Cotillard came close to possibly getting a nomination for James Gray's The Immigrant. She was nominated for an Oscar for 2 Days, One Night that year. And she split at the New York Film Critics Circle between The Immigrant and 2 Days, One Night. So basically what I'm saying is that Gray has been sort of right under the surface there. And maybe all it takes is a New Jersey set slice of Americana nostalgia thing. I mean, I'm sure he'll do something more interesting than what I just described. But yeah, that one feels like a potential breakout here, because if nothing else, the Europeans, the French in particular, really like James Gray. Oh, I should say, speaking of the French, Claire Denis has a new film. A filmmaker who's been working for a long time, but just feels all of a sudden like so prolific. She just had a film at Berlin, I believe, in February with Juliette Binoche. And now she has The Stars at Noon with... It has Margaret Qualley, daughter of Andy McDowell, star of the recent Netflix well-reviewed show Made, and Joe Alwyn, who is currently in Conversations with Friends on Hulu. Benny Safdie's in it, John C. Reilly, and it's described as a romantic thriller. So maybe it's kind of going back to Denis' like White Material days. It's an English businessman and an American journalist in Nicaragua during the revolution. So that seems kind of exciting, too. I think, you know, Denis is obviously a favorite at that festival of all the sort of big international festivals. I don't know. Maybe all of that prolific output will finally bear some gold-shaped palm leaves.
I was reading up on that film, and I love sort of the Russian dolls of casting, because it was supposed to star Robert Pattinson, who then couldn't do it, and then who she's obviously worked with before, and then it was supposed to star Taron Egerton, and now it's Joel Alwyn. So you just like get to peek at how one handsome man is replaced by the other for those things. But I'm curious to see that one as well.
Speaking of handsome men and the Sally Rooney universe, Paul Mescal has two films.
Two films.
Yeah, one is from the director, one of the directors of The Fitz, I believe, which was a small but well-regarded Sundance film a few years ago. And this one has Emily Watson in it. Paul Mescal plays her son, and there's some sort of secret that she's guarding for him. And I think it's kind of a thriller. It's A24, which is intriguing. It's in one of the smaller sidebar categories. You know, it's just funny to see, like, we all watched, or a lot of us watched Normal People at the height of the pandemic in 2020. And then here Paul Mescal is a couple years later, like, fully bearing the fruit of that success, is that, like, you know, he's got two movies at Cannes, both of which seem pretty interesting. The other is, I believe, a horror film.
And in one of them, he plays a dad, which I think is interesting because he is a young man and hasn't done that yet. But
not a daddy, but a dad. Yes.
Yeah. An actual dad. So, and yes, the other one is a horror film. So you can definitely get your Paul Mescal fix at Cannes this year.
That's a little narrative. Paul Mescal having a couple films a couple years after his big breakout. Are there any narratives, you know, maybe not film specific, that you're looking at that seems to be kind of emerging from this lineup in aggregate, or anything just about like where the festival is, where we are as moviegoers?
I don't know if it's just my own sensitivity to horror, but it does feel like there's a lot of horror this year, or spooky films. Which does make me wonder if it's just like where people's heads have been at, creatives' heads have been at after a pandemic for a couple years. But that could just be a coincidence and my own sort of bias in trying not to be seeing scary movies. But there is a lot of that. And the other funny coincidence I sort of noticed is that Riley Keough, the granddaughter of Elvis, has her own film, a directorial debut at the festival. So she will also be there. It's called War Pony. It's set on a Native American reservation, and she co-directed it. But I thought that was such a weird coincidence.
Yeah, it almost feels like preordained or something.
Yeah, it's interesting.
I'm pretty sure that Priscilla Presley will be in attendance at the festival. She was at the Met Gala. Like, they're really, the Elvis campaign is really up and running now. And I would assume, I don't know how much Keo likes to talk about that aspect of her life, but I'm sure she'll be there in at least some support of Elvis and her own film. And her own film, War Pony, has an interesting origin story. She and her co-director, who also is her co-producer, they have a production company together. When Riley was filming American Honey, she met these two guys who were extras in that movie, and she got to talking to them, and they had really interesting stories about growing up on the reservation, and those stories turned into this screenplay. And I believe in the kind of Chloe Zhao, Sean Baker style, they found brand new, untested actors from, you know, the communities that they're depicting in the film. And so it has that kind of, it feels a little bit like on paper, like it might be paying homage, let's say, to the styles of those two filmmakers, Zhao and Baker. But I think that hopefully any criticism of like, well, why is Elvis's granddaughter like parachuting into this very fraught community, Lakota Reservation in South Dakota, to tell this story? But the screenwriters, actually, these are their stories. So I think hopefully that will help buttress it some against any kind of backlash.
Yeah. What about you, Richard? Do you see any other interesting trends or narratives popping
well,
up?
Well, I mean, I think the horror thing is always of note at every festival more and more, because so-called elevated horror seem to be the things that really break out of the festival in terms of eyeballs and attention, but also in terms of box office. So if people are turning to that. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as ever, Cannes is interesting for the way that it brings back people who are sort of in their repertory company. You know, we have the Dardens back, we have Desplechin back, we have Christian Mungiu, the Romanian filmmaker, Ostlin, Park Chan-wook. But then they choose another filmmaker here and there, Kelly Reichardt, Lucas Don't, who are at different phases in their career and are finally getting invited into the big competition. So I'll be curious to see if this is a year with a jury led by Vincent Landon, who's a French actor, like where that jury will go in terms of, do we want to give the award to the big, new, exciting thing the way that Julia Ducournau did for Titan last year, or if they'll give it to an old master to kind of, I don't know, Top Gun style proof that the old people still have it. I don't know. I'm also looking forward to some kind of Top Gun stunt, by the way. Like,
I know, we didn't even talk about Tom Cruise probably, like, I don't know, landing a helicopter on the Hotel du Cop or something. But
I hope he does a flyover in a jet, you know, and shakes all the tables at the Carlton Beach Club. You know. But that feels like a perfect, I think we talked about it last week, but a perfect sort of confluence of star potential and or star power, rather, and old brand awareness and the ridiculousness of Cannes, like a Top Gun sequel that Tom Cruise is very heavily marketing. That feels like a good fit for Cannes. I think Cannes, we go for the elevated art house stuff, but it's also fun to have the big commercial stunts as well.
Yeah, and it's the 75th anniversary, so I do think we can anticipate there being, you know, some sort of celebration for that. And I know on the 70th anniversary, there was a really amazing gala where they had a bunch of filmmakers there. And I feel like, you know, after a sort of quiet, strange festival last year, this will really hopefully be back to form and be exciting. And by the time people listen to this, we'll be there.
Oh, yeah, we should say, as you're listening to this, we are already in France, probably, hopefully, filing something. Maybe I'll have a review or two up of, I don't know, the new zombie movie from the guy who made The Artist. But yeah, we'll be covering it throughout the whole festival. And Rebecca, you'll be kind of on the more interviewing and seeing beat, right? Is that kind of your purview?
Yeah. I mean, my plan is to obviously see as many of the films, especially potential award contenders, as possible, but also do interviews on the ground. I sort of love the chaos of Cannes and getting talent to talk while they're running from premiere to press conference and, you know, downing a glass of rosé between those things. So it's always a really fun festival. And then we'll both be attending events and hopefully covering some of the bigger ones as well. So we'll be busy, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that I can come to some of the cool parties that you're going to. Sometimes they limit it to one person per outlet. But I'll be reviewing, and maybe, I don't know. I mean, sometimes stories emerge from Cannes that you don't expect, and it takes the shape of, can you believe that this 57-year-old woman is playing a 6-year-old Celine Dion, you know, and that becomes its own thing. So I think, yeah, the madness of Cannes is part of the point, and we're excited to be there. Well, I guess my last question for you, Rebecca, and it's an important question. How many gowns, how much formal wear are you packing? Because I'm trying to figure out.
Well, you have it easy, Richard. You can wear the same
But I have to bring, how many suits do I bring? Because you don't always want to wear a black suit if it's an afternoon-y cocktail thing on the beach. That doesn't really work.
There are a lot of those things too. I overpack so much. It's embarrassing. Like I look like I'm moving to France for a month. If you see a woman walking down the street with four large suitcases, it's probably
that's you. And if you see someone frantically running into Zara to buy some sort of something, it's me, as I've done almost every year, because oops, the suit from last year doesn't fit anymore. When you walk to the top floor of the one Zara on Rue d'Antibes, there's just right when you get to the men's floor, a huge rack of black clip-on bow ties, because they know that's the thing that people forgot or didn't think to bring. So anyway, I will see you on the Croisette. I'm so excited. And all of you listening, please keep an eye out for our coverage on VF.com.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Well, Jordan, I feel like I never thought that I would have you on our awards podcast to talk about Star Trek. And I wish it was because there was a Star Trek movie that had Oscar buzz and we could really be diving deep on it. But you are our friend and our colleague, and you have a book about friendship and Star Trek, which I do think is one of the more fascinating aspects of Trek lore. As someone who's not a sci-fi person, this sci-fi franchise that is built in many ways on like friendship and human optimism and relationships is really charming. And I, you know, having read some of your book, I think that's what you really dive into in this book, right?
Yeah, 100%. As far as awards are concerned, Star Trek has won many Emmys in the technical categories.
That
makeup, special effects, sound design, things of that nature. Yeah, so the Star Trek Book of Friendship is a gift book. You know, it's a cute little book. You're not walking around with Dostoevsky when you hold this book in your hand. It's a collaboration between me and a very good friend of mine named Rob Perlman, who I met on the Star Trek circuit, which sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but Rob has been writing humor-related Star Trek books for years. This is his 10th one. He wrote Fun with Kirk and Spock was his first one. It was a best-selling book, a very cute kind of play on Fun with Dick and Jane in the Star Trek world. And I have been working as a panel moderator and host at Star Trek conventions for over a decade, places like Las Vegas, Nevada, and, L.A., New York, Chicago, London, Germany, and five times in a row, the Caribbean Sea on the Star Trek cruise.
Right. Cruises are back.
The cruises are back, baby. Anyhow, so Rob and I met, and we have become Star Trek friends. And a lot of people who are deep into Star Trek have Star Trek friends. And when the pandemic first started, Rob was thinking, what should my next book be about? He was thinking about the friendships he's seen at conventions. Not every Star Trek fan goes to conventions, but just sort of the friendships that he's witnessed that are made about the show, and then started thinking about friendships within the show. So he's like, I want to write a book about, you know, the relationship between Kirk and Spock, Riker and Picard, Janeway and B'Elanna, Odo and Quark, which is a frenemies friendship. I could go on. And then realize the best way to write about it would be with a Star Trek friend. And since it was the pandemic, we did not actually meet in person. He lives in Jersey. I live in Queens. We were just doing it over Zoom and we were supposed to be working. And instead, we were doing what we do, which is make Star Trek jokes at each other and just kind of babbling. And he had the realization of this is actually our book. It's a dialogue. We should just be talking to one another. The concept of the book should be, we've invited you over to our house. We're going to watch Star Trek, and we're going to talk about all these relationships. So we talked and talked and talked and tried to hit all of the important relationships. And then we turned that into a book and got a very well-regarded illustrator from the comic book world, J.K. Woodward, to do the artwork, some of which is direct representation of screenshots from the movies and films. Some of them are more creative out of his head. There are some images in there that like Star Trek fans would always have wanted to see, like, Garak helping Bashir get into a suit, which means nothing to somebody who doesn't watch Deep Space Nine, but means a lot to a lot of people. Or, like, Dr. Bashir and Chief O'Brien in the Hollow Suite, but at the Alamo, which is something they talk about a lot, but you never actually see. So this is exciting for fans, but for non-fans, or for less, you know, fans that aren't so hardcore, it's a fun, breezy little book about friendship and how Star Trek as a franchise has been around for 55 years. It can't just be about cool ships and sci-fi concepts. There has to be a human element, even if we are sometimes talking about Klingons and Vulcans and Bajorans, the human element of characters and how that makes intriguing television.
Well, yeah, this is what I wanted to ask you about generally, because, you know, we have the Fast and Furious franchise that says it's all about family, and we have the Marvel Universe where everyone thinks that if Wanda had better friends, then she wouldn't have gotten to be the villain in Doctor Strange. But is Star Trek, I mean, A, the original franchise built on friendships, is it still doing it better than anybody else?
I mean, on TV, I mean, I maybe there's some things that predate it, but I mean, yes, I mean, part of what makes an episode of Star Trek work is you know that Kirk and Spock love each other. And Bones and Spock can't stand each other but love each other too. You know, and it informs every decision that they make. You know that they've got each other's back. And the other thing about the show, when you think about it, it, like other good shows that are about friendships, think about Cheers, right? Mm-hmm. That's a work show. They all go to work at the bar.
Yep.
Norm and Cliff. Are they working? Maybe. But they all go to work at the bar. Star Trek is a work show. They wake up in the morning, they go to work. You got the image of Chekhov and Sulu, like, at the front. They kind of share a desk. You know, they're mm-hmm. at the front at the helm. The boss is behind them in the captain's chair telling them what to do. And they can give each other looks and roll their eyes. And it's people at the office. Then they go to the doctor. They're all on the job. And then they can clock out and hang out at 10 forward at the bar and talk about the day they had at work and fighting aliens and brokering intergalactic peace. But, you know, by and large, it's a work show. And those are friendship shows. I think in terms of, like, fandom, you know, sort of these quote-unquote nerdy franchises, I think that is part of what appeals to a lot of people is finding friends and finding those relationships in the work that, you know, maybe don't exist in your real life.
I think of more and more people talking about the MCU as a kind of long-running, indefinite television series. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely connects to what you're talking about. That's kind of been the cornerstone of TV, and especially TV's earlier days when you had long, indefinite runs, is why did people continue to invest? And it was the relationships on the show that were often not romantic.
So, Jordan, you and all the Trek that's on TV right now, it's kind of a weirdly golden age for Star Trek because of Paramount Plus. You wanted us to watch Strange New Worlds. And I don't know if it's because it holds up this ethos of Star Trek or just because it's the best one that's on right now.
Well, Strange New Worlds, we're recording this right now, and the third episode is dropping in a couple of days. So it's still very early. I've had the me and other critics, we've seen the first five episodes. So it's still early. We don't know exactly where it's going to go. But Strange New World is exciting because it's a really, really, really good place for people who are completely new to Star Trek that maybe haven't even seen the Chris Pine films, but have heard about Star Trek their whole lives. It's been around for 55 years, but it can be a little bit intimidating. Oh my God, where the heck do I start? And if somebody says start at the beginning, if you watch the original series, although I love it and so many other people do, it is a 55-year-old show, so it has a different pacing than shows of today. And Strange New Worlds really does have the sensibility of that first series, the original series. It has that attitude, that kind of zippy, fun. Every episode is not particularly tied to the one before it. You don't have to know a heck of a lot. It's just fun and funny and has a good message and oftentimes has some wild sci-fi in it. And there are the characters that you kind of sort of know. Spock is in it. He's
right.
Strange New Worlds is set 10 years before the original series. So it's a younger Spock, but he's still Spock. And Ethan Peck, who is Gregory Peck's grandson, is the new Spock, and he is great. And Zachary Quinto played Spock in the recent movies, and he was very good Ethan Peck is great. I mean, there's only one Leonard Nimoy, but there are two Spocks.
Mm.
Bangs gavel. I mean,
wow.
Ethan Peck has got it. He's got the voicing. He's got the humor. He's not doing an impersonation of Leonard Nimoy, but he is mind melded, if you will, with the concept of Spock. And he's very, very, very funny. There's also the young Uhura in this. And it's funny. I mean, even though I've only seen five episodes, there's 55 years of Uhura in Star Trek lore. There's more Uhura in these five episodes than in the 55 years. I mean, in 1966, when Star Trek launched, it was revolutionary to have a black woman on the bridge of a ship in an important role with a title, and she had a function, and she was wonderful and great, but she didn't do that much other than simply be there. And in fact, Nichelle Nichols was frustrated and wanted to leave the show. This is a very famous story in Star Trek lore, but not everybody knows this. She wanted to leave the show. She was a singer, a stage singer prior, wanted to get back to that because she was like, I'm on the show and it's cool and I wear a cool outfit, but I don't really do much. And it was none other than Martin Luther King who told her to stay on the show, because just by simply being there, that's a pretty big name to tell you what to do with your television career, said, stay on that show because you were inspiring a lot of people simply by being there. So yes, yeah. Uhura has been great over the years and has had wonderful moments. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, she has a really good moment when she whips out her phaser. But in the new show, there's a lot more going on with her. And other characters in the new show, some are brand new to the show, others are from lore from the old days, but were minor in the old days and are now more pronounced. Nurse Chapel, for example, only gets a couple of lines in the original series here and there. Now she's a major character and expanded upon. And
but this is all stuff that, like, if you're me and you don't remember any of, like, I have seen the Star Trek movies, but like there's no requirement to, like, they're there for fans, but not.
Yes, all of this stuff is 100% you don't need to know. If you've never heard the name Nurse Chapel before, when you meet her on Strange New Worlds, she's just a new spunky nurse who's a lot of fun, played by this wonderful Australian actress. Dr. Mbenga also is from the original series. He was in two episodes. Hardcore nerds know him, but if you don't know Dr. Mbenga from back then, you know him now. And yeah, there's a couple of things. I mean, technically, Strange New Worlds is a spinoff of Discovery, which is entering its fifth season soon and has a bit of a complicated legacy to it. And to kind of jump right into Discovery now would involve a little bit of homework. You don't need to know much of anything going into Strange New Worlds. And what you don't know is explained to you. There's a, you know, a little bit of exposition to get you up to speed in episode one. And by the time you get to episode two, you're off to the races. So there's a couple of things, but they do a really good job of keeping you up to date.
Is Michelle Yeoh still on Star Trek Discovery?
She is not. Okay. She, I mean, you never know on Star Trek. They can come back.
Sure.
She is not. She entered the Guardian of Time portal, and she went back. Her original character was killed, but then her mirror universe counterpart came back. Mm-hmm. And then she zoomed away to a different point in time and space. There were rumors that they were going to build a spinoff based on her character called Section 31, which is like a dark arts, black operations, CIA type thing. I don't know if that series is actually going to happen. It has not been officially greenlit. There's been talking about it for years. If I were a betting man, I would imagine that it's not going to happen.
I was just thinking about how she's like in, you know, this massive movie and is like in this huge moment, and she's been on a Star Trek show that I haven't been watching, and I felt kind of bad about it.
Right, right. She's been a high point. She was never, for a little stretch, she was in every episode. She was my wife's favorite character. Let's put it that way. When she would show up, she was really good. Yeah, Discovery has a lot of great characters. It's a little bit of work to get into Discovery because the first season was a little rocky. They took some big swings that didn't really connect, but there are some great things. There are some great, you mentioned Michelle Yeoh. You know who else is on Star Trek Discovery that a lot of people know? Tig Notaro is on the show.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, see,
didn't know it.
Nobody knows these things. Tig Notaro is awesome on this show. She is one of the engineers, and she, most of her scenes are against Anthony Rapp. Now, you knew Anthony Rapp was on Discovery,
right? I did, because he's been on, wasn't he on previous Star Trek?
No, but he was one of the he was on Discovery. He's one of the above the title. Yeah.
Okay.
So he's been on Discovery. He's in every episode. He's a major, major character. So dig this. On a random episode of Discovery, you've got at least one scene of Tig Notaro and Anthony Rapp hurling sassafras at each other. Just like, it's really, really funny. They're just sarcastic. And we talk about this in the Star Trek Book of Friendship. Their relationship is a relationship founded entirely on sarcasm. And it's really, really fun to watch. So she's on the show. Did you know that David Cronenberg, the director, is on Star Trek Discovery?
I feel like maybe somewhere in my brain I did, but not really.
I mean, I know David Cronenberg. Yeah, he may. I it is ringing a bell because I know he appears weirdly. I think it popped up on Twitter one time.
Yeah, people occasionally put a picture of him on Twitter with the thing like, "Did you?" So David Cronenberg plays like. All right, so I'm not. They go off in the. They're in the way future, and it's the year 3000 zillion whatever, and. Well, whatever. He plays like an important, I don't know what his exact title is. He's like the admiral of something or other. And he handles like intelligence and security in the future for the Federation of Planets. And he like shows up and does these interrogation scenes. And it's David Cronenberg. I mean, why? They shoot it in Toronto. And, you know, he's the king of Toronto film.
He's right down the street.
Yeah, he's right down the street. I think it started off, it maybe was like a gag to put him in one episode, but he's kind of a bit, he's not a major character, but he's a semi-regular. And he's had some important scenes, you know?
Because Star Trek is the kind of thing where you'll get all kinds of people who are like, I've always wanted to be on the bridge of the Enterprise. Like, I'll come. I don't know if the Enterprise is in Discovery. Well, wait, so David, you watch Strange New Worlds as well. And like, I think you maybe don't know a ton about Star Trek like me.
I do not.
Okay.
yeah, let's see. On a non-Star Trek note, I was thrilled to be able to count myself among those who are aware of the Anson Mount Assance.
I mean, just seeing shots of him on Twitter, like that Anson. Silver well, hair been and everywhere, that uniform, and I felt know.
I've had that FOMO. I've had Anson FOMO. And as someone who watched the entire first season of Hell on Wheels, this was major for me.
Good. Wow.
Yeah, another thing I really liked the episode that I saw, and one thing that felt throwbacky in the best way was I assume it's a pretty episodic show, and I know that other spin-offs or Star Trek shows on right now are not, or more season-long arcs. It's nice to be able to just have a more procedural element with these shows sometimes. So that was very refreshing. And yeah, I was also looking at it because of the assignment here through the lens of friendship. And so knowing even that this was a spin-off, and I think it was like those three, number one, Spock and Pike and Captain Pike. I know Star Trek. like knowing that there was some desire for those characters to have their own show and being able to see that play out. Yeah, I'm on board.
Yeah.
Pun intended.
Well, you know, if you're into the Anson Mount thing, second episode, you do see him wearing a space apron, making dinner for a large party.
Sounds great.
So it's pretty cool. There's a lot of him coming up. And I will say, and here's another scoop for Little Gold Men. As I mentioned, I have been very lucky to sort of be a fan moderator, panel moderator for Star Trek for a long time. He was on the cruise in 2020. And even though it was a convention, he was on stage. The shortest shorts imaginable. maybe they weren't brand Birkenstocks, but definitely like those types of sandals. And not just by the pool. On stage also. So,
yeah. You know, it was he's on vacation.
He was on vacation and he's a very charming fellow. They all are. So
I'm grateful to you for noticing the short shorts and bringing that information back to us. Well, Jordan, people are invested in not just short shorts, but friendship. They can buy your book everywhere, right?
Yeah, it's on the Amazon. It is in some stores. A friend of mine was so excited, went to the store, and there were supply chain issues, so it wasn't there yet. But it's coming to stores if it's not there already. But Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, all the other places. The Star Trek Book of Friendship. It's a great gift if you have a Star Trek friend. If your brother-in-law loves Star Trek and it's his birthday, great gift for him. And it's a great time to get in on this Strange New Worlds. If you've been dragging your feet about Paramount Plus, you know, try the free membership for a month or however long the free membership is. And this show is a lot of fun.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. Richard and Rebecca will continue sending us dispatches from Cannes. And you can read lots of other stuff at vanityfair.com. You can follow us on Twitter. We're all at Little Gold Men. And on our own, I am at Katie Rich. And David?
David Canfield 97.
And our special guest, Jordan, tell us where you are on Twitter and anywhere else you want people to find you.
Yes, you can read my work sometimes at vanityfair.com. I've been freelancing for vanityfair.com for well over a decade and enjoyed every moment of it. And in addition to that, you can find me on Twitter at Jay Hoffman. And if you're ever in Queens, New York, just shout my name and we'll come hang out.
You can also set up a text with us at joinsubtext.com/littlegoldmen or text 917-746-3771. This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for the best thing we can all hope to be saying walking out of a summer movie this year goes to Jordan Hoffman.
It's idiotic, but it's good.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.